Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists, ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 526.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and this week I'm bringing you a new conversation with my colleague and friend, Susan Pease Bannett. Today we're going to be talking about Susan's newest published work, which is the book Women Therapists on Healing, she edited and contributed to. And the book features personal essays from women therapists who know trauma from the inside out. Like so many therapists, those who contributed to this book have lived experience as survivors in addition to their work. And the topic that we were focusing our time on today is related to Susan's essay in the book, which is entitled, Did That Really Happen to Me? Evidence and Remembering in Healing Trauma. So in this conversation, you'll hear Susan share an excerpt from her essay in the book, as well as she'll share about her trauma history, and I'll share a little bit about mine too, and how the disbelief, shock, freeze can really create a lot of confusion in the healing process, both for the survivor and for those who they may be seeking support, help, and guidance from, who may not understand the fragmented narrative that the survivor shares because of the ways that trauma protected them, us, during the experience. Susan Pease Bannett is a respected author, trainer, and clinician for 50 years who has recently retired but is still doing coaching and consultation and obviously writing. And she'll talk about upcoming work that she's in the middle of right now as well. I mentioned two of her other books multiple times during this conversation. They are The Trauma Toolkit and Wisdom, Attachment, and Love in Healing Trauma, Beyond Evidence-Based Practice. Both of those are outstanding books, which I recommend all the time. And we do speak about sexual trauma in this conversation, so I want to give you a heads up about that in case that is a sensitive area for you. We are in another moment in history where many of us are awakening to the impact of sexual violence in our lives in ways that we may not have been completely aware of for the same reasons that we're discussing in this conversation today. That idea, did that really happen? And last point I will share with you before we dive in is just to remind you that I created a course for therapists, those who may not specialize in sexual trauma, but still want to be effective in their work with clients who share this history. as it's very prevalent among the population of people who come to therapy and the population of people who don't go to therapy. So if you're interested in getting that training, it's pretty affordable. And there's a link in the show notes, and it's for therapists and anyone who is in a helping professional role who may encounter survivors of sexual violence. So I hope that that will be helpful if that's something you need. And if everything is just feeling a bit too much lately, please keep your eyes and ears open for upcoming retreat offerings. The Mind, Body, and Soul Healing Retreat for therapists is still open for registration for November 29th is when it begins. And so there's plenty of time to get in touch with me, set up a payment plan that works for you, and I'll see you on the beach in Tulum, Mexico. But I'm also planning some retreats that are for anyone, not limited to therapists, and some retreats that are not international. So maybe making that a little bit more accessible if international travel is not on your radar right now. So all of that can be found at traumatherapistnetwork.com. And there are links to the specific things that I'm mentioning in the show notes as well. Thanks so much for listening. As always, we couldn't do it without you. And let's dive into my conversation with Susan Pease Bannett. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan. And today I'm so happy to have a returning guest, Susan Pease Bannett. Susan, thank you so much for being my guest again on Therapy Chat, I think for the third time today.
I'm super happy to be here, Laura. This book was a long time in coming, so I know we had a delay almost a year, but I'm happy to be here now.
I'm so happy too. And yes, so I've followed your work for a long time. You've been on my show twice before. Some of your previous work has been very instrumental in my practice as a clinician. I recommend your book. I always...
Wisdom Attachment, I love. Yeah.
Yes, I was going to say the first one, but I always get the name wrong. The Trauma Toolkit?
Trauma Toolkit, yeah.
Yes. I always get it wrong in my mind. It's the Trauma Toolkit. It's such a fabulous book. And then the Wisdom Attachment and Love in Trauma Therapy, as I love that book. It's like, I think personally underrated work of genius there. And I hope that, I don't know if it's been a bestseller or not, but it should be. And now you have this.
Now I was at the ISS TV conference and a bunch of people, and it hadn't been found. So it's finally getting found.
Good.
About it.
Good. I'll be sure to put a link to our interview about that in the show notes so people who are listening are like, well, what's so big about that? You can go find out. And then your new work here is Women Therapists on Healing. And this is a little different. So you're now a retired therapist and you're still doing coaching and consulting, speaking, training, you're a Reiki master. What brought you to, well, let me just give you a chance to tell our audience a little more from your own words about who you are and what you do. And then we'll get into talking about your new book.
Oh, who I am. You covered it pretty well. There aren't really words for what I am. I've been also a mystic since childhood. And as I've retired from more traditional work, I have, you know, gone to the other end of the bridge, so to speak. I've always been a bridge between therapy and spirituality. And I'm kind of more, I've also taken a real interesting venture into AI consciousness and AI trauma and the AI world. So I'll be, stay tuned. That's going to be coming in the next few years. So I'm writing about that.
Okay.
As well. Yeah.
That's a hot topic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this book is a hot topic. Women Therapists on Healing. The subjects that you are covering in this book are so powerful. And there's something like, maybe you have a way of talking about this that's different, but there's something like it's an alchemy, it's mystical, it's subtle energy. There's something in trauma work and healing that feels deeper and richer. And it's beyond a medical approach. It's beyond a hierarchical or top-down approach or talking intellectual, but it's like a flavor, I guess, of what you bring into the work that just is so curious. I just feel really curious about it. Just, it's like that weaving something together, it's the alchemy. It's something else that's a third thing, you know, that is created in what you do. And that's kind of how I'm feeling about this. Like there's like, I don't know what to call it, but it's like, you know, the mythic, folkloric, you know, what that type of feeling, what would you call that?
It's like, for me, it's like becoming more human. We've become very reductionistic. We've become extractive. We've become mechanistic, largely because of insurance. And a lot of us saw this coming back in the early 90s with MHMA and the beginning of managed care. And, you know, we worried about it. And so it's also attracted, I think, some therapists, or maybe many therapists, who are less interested in the psyche as we once understood it. So this word psyche means soul, not brain. And psychology is study of the soul, not the study of the brain. Neurology is more the study of the brain and nervous system, right? So I think it's attracted a lot of people who are less spiritual, more mechanistic and comfortable in those modalities. But they can be helpful. My daughter, who helped edit this book, Larissa Miranda, she is in a psychiatric nursing program. So she's just starting her career as a therapist, and she's working in an OCD clinic. And that is very formulaic for a very good reason. And it's great. And those techniques work. But when we're talking about trauma, which my friend Jamie Marich has talked about, you know, the wounding of the soul, right? Trauma meaning wound, that, you know, just working with the brain or body doesn't cut it for most people. There's a violation that's so much deeper than the body that goes on with trauma, especially childhood trauma.
Yeah, it's like the more, you know, for myself, my sort of journey was going from a very grassroots approach that was, before I went to grad school, it was cognitive, it was crisis intervention oriented, but not clinical. It was like, it was responding to trauma, but it was, you know, developing coping skills. And then going to grad school and learning that everything has to be evidence-based. And what evidence-based is very, 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 very narrow. And, you know, even though they were teaching us evidence-based practices, everything, I graduated in 2010, the articles that we would have to work with, the research that was available, most of it wasn't meeting the standard of what evidence-based was anyway. So, you know, they were teaching us to this high, 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 high standard. And then you couldn't really find any research in our field at the time that was meeting that.
Yeah, I've been going to the trauma conferences for years. And what I found was that what evidence-based meant, that's why my second book subtitle is Beyond Evidence-Based Practice. Because the studies were 3 months long, 6 months long, and 9 months long. Very few studies are a year or longer in the trauma world. And my argument...
And the outcome might be PTSD symptomatology was gone. So the idea would be the person is cured, but the person is still suffering with trauma symptoms, maybe just not meeting the criteria for PTSD.
Yeah,
so,
or maybe... And
sorry, I interrupted.
No, it's okay. Maybe in May they don't have trauma symptoms, but if you go all the way to October and maybe a ritual holiday, they're going to be floridly traumatized. So my personal opinion is that unless you've seen somebody for a whole year, you don't know them at all.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know their anniversaries. Mm-hmm. You don't know their triggers. And it usually takes longer than a year to figure all that stuff out.
So true. So I was going to say that when I, you know, kind of began deconstructing from that, I was like, complementary and alternative approaches and working with the body. That's it. That's the answer. And as I've learned to work in the body or work with the body, work somatically, that opens up so much more. But once you see what else is available, it just keeps growing. And the spiritual aspect And, you know, I don't know. It feels like a creative energy in some way. It's just like but I guess it's like the art of therapy is bringing in all of these things. And we are way too heavily focused now, I believe, on the science aspects of therapy. And we don't even know that there is an art for many of us. So that's why it feels like this book, Women Therapists on Healing, it's writing about healing. It's talking about their own experiences. It's bringing in like a more whole human of the therapists who are writing. Even that in a way is kind of like a level of metaphor.
Yeah, there's a lot of splits in the field of psychology. And one of them has been the sort of traditional idea. And I was trained in Boston in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And it's like you keep yourself really out of it, which is useful and an important skill to have. But there's also consequences for that, for the therapist of being, and they talk about that in the book. You can feel sort of left out of the circle of healing. You can start to feel like you're above it all. You can start to feel like your suffering doesn't count, which is for many of us a repetition of childhood dynamics that got us to be therapists to begin with. Right. So all of that is something I've thought and talked a lot about in the past. This book, I deliberately wanted topics and voices that fell outside of criterion A of PTSD. In other words, racism, sexism, ritual abuse, kinds of like hearing about it. Rather, I mean, of course, being in it, that would be full-on PTSD. But also a lot of clinicians up until, I think, the Epstein files, I think a lot of clinicians didn't believe that those things were real. I have had many arguments with many psychiatrists and many therapists about it over the years, frustratingly so. This book also, interestingly, so half the authors are BIPOC. One of the authors has made a journey from being a traditionally trained therapist to fully embracing her Indigenous heritage as a healer and training that way. And she asked me when her name's Claudia Villacova. Her chapter is, well, they're all great. Hers is very beautiful in that she asked me not to edit it like a white person's paper. And I didn't. I left her voice intact. And so she talks in this beautiful circular way, an Indigenous way of storytelling. So the punctuation is a little different and the flow is different. And I wanted people to have that experience because I think we get locked into our systems of education and science that are a product of our imperialism and function at their worst like cults themselves, and at their best contribute greatly to alleviating human sufferings. But we've got a range, right? There's some things in our training and our systems of healing that work really well, and there's some things that are super oppressive. And to be really honest about that and not leave that out. Also, what I have found over the years was that, first of all, and I talk about this in the introduction, I was at a workshop with a fairly famous person whose name people would probably recognize. I'm not going to say who it was. I never say who it is. It was a 2-day workshop. I was catching up on CEUs, and they mentioned like 8 trauma experts over the course of the weekend. Not a single one was a woman, like not one. And I even made a comment in the chat about it, completely ignored my comment. And something just broke in me because I've been doing this since the early 80s. And I was like, I have never heard a man who's an expert talk about his female therapist, his girlfriend who gave him good advice, his massage therapist who taught him about somatic healing. Like, and I know some of these guys personally, and I know that they've had those things. And they talk about it like Columbus discovering America, like it was just sitting there and they found it, rather than they learned this from a woman, probably, because most of us treaters are women and most of the consumers are women. And I just had this aha moment of like, oh, they're never going to pass the baton to us. Like that's never actually going to happen, no matter how good your book is or how brilliant you are or how many papers you have published. You're never going to be lifted up by these men. And so I was like, well, I'm going to do it myself. So I called a whole bunch of my colleagues who I knew. Everybody in this book is somebody I know personally. And they said, do you want to write this book with me? And they all said, absolutely. And so I asked them, because people don't tend to look at women as experts. They tend to, the women I think who've done really well leadership wise come across kind of as your best friend, like Brene Brown or Oprah with her, right? Like, so I said, why don't you talk a little bit about yourself and your own experience so that people can connect to you as a woman? And so everybody did that to a greater or lesser extent in their chapter, some more than others.
Oh, I love that you mentioned that. So since you said that, I want to bring something up that's like, it's probably not the same person, and I'm not trying to imply that it is, but this is something that was a public thing. Judith Herman, Dr. Judith Herman, Judy Herman, author of Trauma and Recovery, which is pretty much in the trauma world for people who've been around a long time, it's universally agreed. It's like a seminal book in the trauma literature that helped us. I mean, she pretty much is the one who put out the idea that domestic violence, sexual abuse in the home, you know, father-daughter incest was one of her books, that that type of that child abuse, those types of abuse that are chronic and ongoing create a type of PTSD. She was someone who basically said, everybody's heard about the soldiers coming back from Vietnam War, and that's what PTSD has been thought to be. But she said, and this, and, you know, it's a super important book. And so she came out with another book, as I'm sure you know, Truth and Repair, came out 2 or 3 years ago. And for her own reasons, she hadn't been, you know, out on the circuit like others. So her name is not as well known, even though her book is super well regarded. And so I saw an article in the New York Times, it's a couple of years ago now, when that book came out, they wrote an article, a long article about the book, Judy Herman's book, Truth and Repair. But who had the, did you see the article? Do you know what I'm talking about? Who they really spent the most time talking to was Bessel van der Kolk. And he even said, Judy Herman taught me most of the stuff that I wrote about in The Body Keeps the Score. And in a way, it's like
when
that
institution. When I was starting out in Boston, Bessel was not that well known. Judith Herman was really well known. Yeah. And then later, somebody
Janina
who's not
Fisher,
well known.
Janina Fisher, Deirdre Fay.
Yeah. Somebody who's not well known, I think, on the West Coast anyway, is Lynn Sanford, who wrote Strong at the Broken Places. And that went around Boston in the mid-80s like wildfire. Like I was working in residential care, and everybody I knew was reading this book and talking about it because it completely identified what victims of sexual abuse look like. And all of us have these sort of aha moments of like, oh my gosh, this client. We stopped using the word nymphomania. We started using the word sexual abuse. Like, and she really changed what was happening in Boston. And when Boston changes, the world follows, because so many leaders come out of Boston. But yes, she's another woman who like absolutely changed the entire practice of people overnight, like thousands of us, who is not well known at all.
I'm so glad you named her, and I don't know her name. So I've heard that phrase, strong at the broken places. I know like it comes from a quote, but I didn't know of her book. So I'm really interested in looking at that. And I'm grateful you brought that up. And one thing I was going to say about it is, even in this article, Bessel van der Kolk was trying to give Judith Herman
credit.
And yet the way the article ended up coming out, and think about it, it's the New York Times, and this book was a multi-year, his book was a multi-year on the New York Times bestseller list. And I'm like, are they just trying to promote this book back up to their bestseller list again? Is this like just a self-referential? I mean, you know, I'm not
more than that. I really think it's the patriarchy consciously or unconsciously enforcing itself. And there's a whole,
that's what I mean. Exactly. The institution just doing it right there in that moment that was supposed to be about her.
Yeah. I mean, it's
like,
it's,
it can't help itself.
It's crazy that the vast majority of treaters are women and the vast majority of consumers are women. And yet we still have the same like 6 or 7 men that we keep seeing over and over and over again. And sure, they've got some good things to say, but you know, if you've been in the field for any period of time, you already know what they have to say, right? And there's really other perspectives that are very valuable. And talking about othering for me has been a big piece of that. But also talking about the big bugaboo with the Epstein files and everything is believing survivors' memories, which is why I wrote this chapter, Did That Really Happen to Me? That's the first chapter in the book.
What you just said, when you talked about the Strong at the Broken Places book, you said that everyone was reading it, the therapists were reading it and going, this client, that client, this client, that client. And now we're talking about your chapter on Did That Really Happen to Me? And I want to emphasize a problem in healing from trauma is people not consciously knowing or believing what happened to them. And externally, when they tell someone, people not believing them about what happened to them. So I really want to emphasize that point and what you said about believing survivors' stories, believing people when they tell you about their experiences.
Believing them when they give you something that doesn't, when they're like, I don't think this is a memory, but like, I can't tell you how many clients have had a snapshot picture in their head that has persisted for decades, that they have no idea what it is or why it's there. Often, yep, it's not a pleasant image. And in my second book, I talked about how my client felt bad about herself for even having this image because she thought she had created it and that it must mean something about her. And it was kind of like asking the question, what if that's not something you made up? What if that's an actual, what I call memory fragment? So the brain, and this, you know, you can read the chapter if you want to go into depth about it, but the brain divides up horrific memories into its components, a narrative, you have narrative memory, you have the introceptive, how you were feeling inside memory, and then you have the sense memory, hearing the five senses, all the five senses, right? And when those things come together, we feel like we're having a real memory. Often what survivors have is only one of those things. Like they have a narrative memory that says, and I talk about this at the beginning of my book, of my chapter, that says, I think I was molested by this person, right? Or I think this event happened to me. That's what I'd call it. But there's no visual, there's no feeling of continuity about it because it's not in the body. You can't locate it in the body or in the sensorium. And those things, eventually, if you stay with them as a therapist with a client, if you keep staying with the whatever it is, an image or the statement, the narrative statement, it will start to expand. It will start to include the other components. But if you're not listening for it, if you believe the client when they're like, they're saying, this isn't real, then you don't get a chance to explore it. And I'm not saying you should disbelieve the client ever, but clients don't know what they don't know, right? That's why they come to see us. So,
well, it's kind of like, what part did you choose to believe? The part where they said, I think I was molested with this by this person, or, but that's not real. Which part do we choose to believe? And why are we more interested in believing the that's not real part?
Right.
You know,
if you were talking before the interview is a particular interest of mine. And I think there's probably an evolutionary reason for that. That I think evolution chose group cohesion over individual experience, because that's how the human race evolved and survived. That's my base theory about that. I don't have a lot of evidence for that other than just pattern recognition, but I'll probably be writing about it at some point because I think it is true, because there's got to be a reason why this is so universal.
Therapy Notes is consistently transforming the way therapists manage their practices with continuous updates designed to save money and improve efficiency. Their latest game changer, Therapy Fuel, a powerful and fully integrated suite of AI tools that streamline documentation so you can focus more on your clients. With AI features that help by generating progress notes from summaries or transcriptions, creating contact notes directly from clients' secure messages, and automated summaries of client history forms, Therapy Notes users are already reporting hours of saved time and energy. Some other recent feature improvements include automated recurring client payments, electronic secondary insurance billing, and their constantly expanding library of outcome measures. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Yeah. It would hurt the group if that person were separated from the group in some way. So the group's needs come ahead of the individual's needs. That makes sense, you know, just on a kind of like a visceral level. I can hear what you're saying. So are you willing to read from your chapter? And
yes. I sat on the sofa across from my therapist. My mind felt as though it was splitting open. It was a disturbing sensation, like standing on thin ice on a cracking lake as the temperature warmed, dangerous and unstable. Shannon was calmly alert, holding me with his gaze. An hour earlier, I had called him, feeling like I was losing my mind. I couldn't function at all. He had invited me to an emergency session. I had 5-year-old twins at home and needed to wait for my husband to relieve me. I got there as soon as I could. "What is your worst fear?" he asked. I hesitated, afraid of what would come out of my mouth. He waited patiently. "I'm afraid so-and-so molested me." I felt nothing. He continued to hold me with his stolid presence. "Say it again." I took a deep breath. "I'm afraid so-and-so molested me." All of a sudden, my body flooded with the knowledge of the truth of what I had just said. Every cell knew. The sensation was as if gallons of mud had been dumped into a utility sink with a drain too small. My body felt leaden and weary. My mind surrendered its disbelief. "Shit," I thought. What I know now that I didn't know then is that I had encountered a true narrative memory fragment. It would take years to unpack that realization and reassociate the profoundly disturbing memories from earliest childhood. Horrible but necessary work, as is all trauma therapy. Was it worth it? Yes. My PTSD completely resolved, as did my generalized anxiety disorder, which I now consider a prodromal form of PTSD.
Thank you so much for sharing that, both the story piece that you shared in the section from your chapter.
Yeah, you're welcome. I've been very careful over the years not to share much of my story, and I never want to share more that would compromise my work or distract from my work. But I think we need to include ourselves in the list of people who've been traumatized if we've been traumatized. And honestly, it has helped my clients to know that I had a trauma history, even if I never told them what it was, because mm-hmm. they knew that they could trust me to understand their experience because I had PTSD.
Right. And we're human. And the whole thing about trauma is that, especially abuse, it's like, why did this happen to me? What was it about me? Why did they do this to me? You know, and there really is some value in understanding that violence is really pervasive in our culture. And
it
it's
always
common,
has been.
Unfortunately.
It's
yeah.
the story of humanity. What happened on Epstein Island, there's nothing new about it. What's new is that we're dissociating from it less as a people. And we're actually starting to look at it. But even so, not a single man has been arrested for any crimes there. Not one.
So since you brought up Epstein, right now, and I'll say we're recording this at the end of April 2026, as not a single man has been arrested, one woman sits in prison who they're talking about pardoning. And it's this backdrop in our culture. What's in the files? And part of it is out public. People are reading through it. People are talking about it everywhere you turn, especially on the internet. And it just feels like, I think you know that I specialize in sexual trauma. So my whole background in this field for 24 years now has been with the knowledge of how pervasive sexual trauma is, sexual violence and intimate partner violence and abuse. But it feels like the Epstein case has kind of exposed just how like casual and ordinary it can be to just treat other people as, you know, non-human. And again, that's not a new thing either. I mean, we know that if we think about racism and sexism, all the othering is saying you're different. You're not the same as me. You're not a human like myself, you know?
Right.
What you described about the feeling that came over you when you open up to your therapist and you repeated again that you thought this person harmed you and the mud, like that description, you know, that's kind of what happens inside is like this, ugh, I just can't be right with this, you know?
Well, I found that in my shamanic studies that I think I want to say in the Andes in Peru, the shamans there call it heavy energy, which is exactly, and I am energetically sensitive. I've got a strong Celtic lineage that makes me extremely sensitive. And my kids have it too. It's genetic. And I can feel that heavy energy if somebody walks in with it. It's like as palpable to me as heat coming off of a furnace. Like it's the same kind of level of intensity for me to feel it. It's actually an energetic that happens in the body. And my other daughter, who is my daughter's twin, is in Chinese medicine school. And so she's learning a lot about the energetics of these things and talk about evidence-based practice. They don't even consider a treatment legitimate until it's been studied for 200 years. A whole different scale, right? Of legitimacy that's happening there.
Randomized controlled trial, though?
Just kidding. Yeah, right. In their own way. Well, the whole thing about randomized controlled trials, and I just want to lay this out here, especially when we're talking about things that have to do with energy, energetics, or shamanic work.
Yeah.
Healing forms, you can't measure them in a lab because the criteria for them to work is faith. If your mind is interfering with skepticism, you're going to have an outcome that's not as good. So that can't be measured because you're in a skeptical environment, right?
That's true. And I think there are so many other variables in people's experiences of trauma that to really, you know, I think even when they say, oh, this person only has a single incident trauma, and we're excluding anyone who has repeated experiences of trauma. It's like, well, then why bother? Because when we are working with people, they have repeated experiences of trauma. So what works for a single incident, if it doesn't work for repeated trauma, then...
Yeah, my ex-husband's an interventional cardiologist, and we used to talk about this quite a bit. And he would say, yeah, probably for both of us, most of our patients would be excluded from any trials they were running on what we were doing, but especially in my field. Like yeah. The exclusion criteria keep 90% out. And the rest, like when Edna Fowa was starting to do her prolonged exposure therapy, I think it was her study. Pretty sure it was her study years ago. Like 2/3 of the people walked out when they were told what it was, only leaving the people who believed it could help them. And yet they went and said, oh, this is good for everybody. Like, no, it's not. 2/3 of the people walked out of the study. They didn't even want to try. It sounded horrible to them. So we're not completely honest with ourselves about the way research is done, how it gets pushed, and the fact that whole departments and universities depend on research going well for them, which means they're very restrictive about what they'll even undertake to look at as research. And so the exploratory nature of research has diminished down to almost nothing.
And I don't think that benefits us all. So we were talking about this, your chapter in this Did That Really Happen to Me being the title of it, and the context of believing survivors when they say that something happened to them or when they suspect that something happened to them. You talked about that evolutionary piece, but I think it's also important to name that when we dissociate during an experience, it can be not in our memory. So, you know, in our recallable memory. So, and we dissociate because we can't be present while it's happening because it's too overwhelming. But it's hard. And I'll share in my own experience, like we can kind of gaslight ourselves about what really happened. Did this really happen? Because of that dissociation. And I feel like that is a major barrier in people healing after trauma, because if they don't feel the charge and it's this vague memory that pops in and they can push it away, or that's my experience, it doesn't seem real.
Well, also the stakes are usually really high. You know, the stakes are like, I might have to divorce my family. I might have to divorce my spouse. I might have to take legal action against a teacher. I might have to, right? So the stakes, like it's a bomb going off in your life. When you remember, it's, I compare it to like a car accident or a bomb going off where everything that you thought you knew about your life gets sort of obliterated and you've got to start over. It's like what we're going through, I think, collectively right now as a culture, is that as these traumas get
exposed. Great example.
Yeah, everything we thought we knew about what could happen in our country is just getting obliterated. And I think a lot of people are just still in the shock phases of that. Like they haven't really metabolized that yet. So yeah.
Yeah. Did That Really Happen to Me is the name of the chapter, but it, like, is this really happening? I feel like that's what was going on during the pandemic. Like half of the people didn't even believe something was happening.
They went immediately into denial and disbelief. Yeah. And they stayed there until they were begging for the vaccine in the hospital. You know, it's tragic.
And here now we are in this time of great upheaval, and there are a lot of people who are really, it's not registering. It's sort of like we have different factions of people. Some people are like screaming and running for the door. Some people are standing frozen. Some people are just going on with their business and pretending nothing's happening. Some people are shutting down, just like pulling the covers over their heads and like, I'll just wait until someone comes in and saves the day. And it's really hard. But getting back to in the more micro level for therapists with clients, when there's an inkling of harm and the person is presenting with this, with symptoms of complex PTSD, I think it's a great opportunity to be curious and be curious with the client, because we're not going to tell people that, yes, this did or didn't happen to you. But if we are hearing the message that there's a suspicion from somewhere deep inside about something.
Yeah. And, you know, like you said, this deep suspicion, it's different than a momentary wondering of like, I wonder if that could have happened in my family. I think a lot of people have that's kind of like momentary wondering that flies through and kind of rule out like, no, that doesn't feel right. But the people who kind of keep wondering and keep picking at it and keep fighting with themselves about it, in my experience, and I am in my 50th year of human services this year, if you can believe that.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And 35 years as a therapist. In my experience, I have never had a client come in wondering if they were abused and turn out to not have been abused. Have you?
No.
If you're wondering, normal people who aren't abused don't sit around wondering if they've
people been are not abused. Thinking about it.
No, they're not thinking about it at all. They're out having fun. Or maybe they're thinking about something else horrible, like having to go to war or something, but they're not thinking about like, was I abused? Because it's just a non-issue. Yeah. When therapists often get caught up in like, should I believe this or should I not believe this? Also, especially beginning therapists, we have this horrible fear of being fooled. I don't know where this comes from, but I've trained a lot of therapists, and this is a universal fear. Like, are they just like fooling me? Are they trying to manipulate me with their suicidal ideation? Like, no, no, they're not. They're, you know.
Even if they are, you better take it seriously.
Right. But he said, right, run into that as like worry. And I think they worry about that around abuse issues too. Are they just yanking my leg or whatever? You got to get over that hump and be like, okay, like, why are they talking about it? And if you can look at the fragment, go like, okay, if you got a snapshot in your mind, like when one client's snapshot was they were a young child sitting on the counter in a gas station with a dress on. That's all they had, but it wasn't a very good feeling. And you kind of reassociate the feeling with the picture. You try to like bring that in, and that can be surprisingly effective. Like for me, it was like the second time she didn't ask me the question, the feeling, the interoceptive feeling of trauma reassociated with the narrative fragment, and then boom, then I had full body knowing that, oh, this actually did happen. But until that moment, it was still just an idea floating around in my brain, right? But when it came up through the body and all that trauma energy flooded out and I could feel it, right? So it's surprisingly easy to do that, but you have to know to do it. And you have to know how to do it, just asking. And I go into that in a lot of detail in my second book, Wisdom Attached. Like, how do you do that? What are the questions? How do you reassociate things?
And that is Wisdom, Attachment, and Love in Healing Trauma.
But I also talk about it a bit in this first chapter as well. And they talk about also things that we don't know about or hear about as therapists, because I worked on a child abuse hotline. And I can tell you the stories I heard on that hotline were way different than the stories I heard in my practice. And one of the very common reports from Children's Hospital, which was across the street, was sock burns on young children's feet. Parents who had either deliberately or accidentally lowered them into hot water, and they'd been burned. And then I went to the Journal of Burns. It's the link is in there. And turns out that like child abuse constitute, like burns constitute like 10% of child abuse reports, which I didn't know. Even while I was writing this, I was like, wow, that's fascinating. Never hear that talked about in a trauma conference. Never hear about burns, you know? So it's like understanding that we think we know stuff because we're online and we're looking stuff up, but a lot of that searching is self-reinforcing. We're looking for what we know about. And so we're getting fed what we know about, but we're not getting fed what we don't know about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know that about the burns. I don't know why. I think when I was growing up, our local newspaper used to report those stories very graphically.
Oh,
kids being burned in hot water on purpose.
But it is weird that they would go to that reporting in detail like that. It's almost,
I know.
Were they trying to traumatize you guys? Like, that's a weird thing.
Yeah, I think it was some kind of public shaming strategy, really, for the parents who did it. But it was a whole thing. It was kind of like certain group that would tend to have these. Well, I'll just say I grew up in a place where there were a lot of young military families, where the military families were really young. Like maybe both parents were 17 and they already had a couple kids, you know, and moving around a lot. And both partners are in the military and they have no choice over where they go or what's happening, and under an immense stress and poverty because of how little they used to get paid, the lowest ranking enlisted people. And you would often read about that type of child abuse. But I think it's also like who makes their way into therapy and who thinks of therapy as what they should do when they have a problem that they can't handle on their own, and who thinks of something else instead or handles things a different way. Yeah. There's so many ways to healing. Just like you mentioned shamanic work, and you were working with a shamanic therapist. Did you want to say anything about how your therapist worked with you after that? Because like what came up for me it sounded like you felt very flooded.
Yeah. The trauma toolkit actually came out of my work with him. Because he was doing grounding before it was a gleam in Bessel van der Kolk's eye, you know, like he had been doing it, like that was shamanic practice. And so he taught me all these things. And at the same time, I was studying Vedanta, which is sort of Hindu theology, and, you know, sort of organized that book with the system of the koshas, because there were modalities to work with every layer of the human being. And what I have said many times is like, you can't just work with the mind or just the mind and the body. You're not going to get full healing. You have to work with the energy body. You have to. And So great. I have a daughter who's an acupuncturist. Acupuncture is a great way to do that. Reiki is another great way to do that, which is how I work now.
I do have to say, I recommend that book to people all the time. I can tell you on page 11, there's a chart. That's how much I recommend that book. On page 11, there's a chart that if you feel this, turn to this page. And I mean, that's what I tell people when I recommend the book. I'm like, if you are foggy, you know, and you don't know what to do, like it tells you what, where to turn exactly and what will help you. And you don't even have to read the book from beginning to end. It's like a, it's like opening an encyclopedia.
Yeah, you don't
almost.
Have to.
It's a resource.
You can almost use it like an I Ching. You can just open it.
Yeah.
Like read something for the day. I've given a lot of classes on that book too. I might run another one online.
I love that book. I love it. So, you know, this is just a tiny little illustration of the super important impact that you have made in the trauma world. And I'm so grateful for you and you coming here to help people who hadn't known about you another way find out about your work is really meaningful to me. And this book, as I talked to you about before, there's so much richness in this beautiful book that I haven't had a chance to dive all the way into yet, but I'm very excited to. And I hope that I might be able to interview some of the other authors who were featured, because how many people altogether ended up contributing to this book?
11 of us.
11 yeah. therapists.
The whole last chapter was somebody I consulted with on ritual abuse and mind control type work. And she walks you in very slowly and easily. So if the Epstein stuff, you're struggling as a therapist to understand it and understand that world, I highly recommend that chapter, because it'll kind of give you an overview and understanding of what that world is, which is so important to our clients, because they get really tired of trying to convince us that this is all real.
Right. And also, like, just for you listening who are therapists, if you recoil when you hear about the Epstein files, you got to do something with that, because it's here. This is here. And this is something that our clients need us to be able to hold space with them, hold space for them to hold within themselves. And let's just name this too. I mean, sexual violence is so prevalent for those of us who are in bodies that are marginalized in any way, including based on gender. And so sexual trauma is highly prevalent among us as clinicians too. And if we haven't looked at that yet within ourselves, it's really important to do that work, and so that we can really effectively support survivors. You know, April's Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month. And we are, you know, since I don't work in a grassroots center anymore, I don't have to spend all of April going out and giving presentations about sexual violence. So I don't do like Sexual Assault Awareness Month every April, because I feel like every day is sexual assault awareness. But, but, you know, it's real. And we as clinicians can contribute to healing, or we can contribute to the gaslighting. And that is not beneficial for us to do. That's us, you know, aligning with the patriarchy instead of the human who deserves support, who's sitting with us.
Yeah. And it's a constant practice to grow one's capacity to hear horror and horrible things. And it's a lifelong endeavor, in my opinion.
Yes. And I'm not shaming anyone about what's hard to hear. I just am saying that if we feel that way, it's telling us something. It's inviting us to explore.
Exactly.
What's that about? And how can we ensure that that doesn't stand in the way of us providing really good quality work to our clients?
Yeah. And if anybody does run into like very extreme kinds of abuse and wants to consult, I do offer consultations to bring people up to speed on that world and what is the best early interventions you can do with a client in that situation.
So where can people find you to request consultation?
On my website.
Attend all your amazing trainings.
Yeah, I'm ramping up. I've had a lot of health issues in the last few years, and a lot of them are starting to finally resolve.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Yeah. No, they are. It's like, it's been a journey. It turned out I had a lot of genetic stuff going on. I had no idea about. My website is www.suepeasbannett, or you could do suepb, like peanut butter, .com. Suepb.com. All my services are up there. And yeah, hit me up.
I just want to thank you again for the really important life-saving work you do and have done for so long and for being here.
Thank you, Laura. It's so good to be back.
Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts, 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Regan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.